Hi, welcome back to the podcast. Adrian from Sophie's here. Renault hosts today, and he's welcoming on Dan Harris, an American attorney with a lot of experience in Chinese law, who's been writing China Law Blog for about 20 years. Dan has shared so much great information over the years, and we're really happy that he's joining us in this episode to give you some helpful and actionable tips about how to protect your intellectual property when you're buying from or manufacturing in China. So let's get into that. You're listening to China Manufacturing Decoded from the Sophie's Group.
Hello, everyone. Today, I am going to have the privilege of asking questions to Dan Harris, who is a partner at Harris Slivovsky, an international law firm based in Seattle, but with offices in several places in the west of the US and a few other places. Maybe Dan can tell us a little bit more about this. He is the longtime writer of the China Law blog, which I've been following, I can't even remember, maybe since 2009 or 2010 at least. So you see how long it's been that I've been following Dan. He's been involved, I'm going to quote from his website, Dan has been involved in matters from contract disputes concerning failed joint ventures to trade secret infringement and economic espionage to product liability to IP litigation. So Dan has a very wide experience in legal matters, especially international business legal matters, and especially with China. As I mentioned, he's been writing extensively about China. His practice has been very busy with assisting his clients get things right in China, let's say. All right. And today we're going to talk about one specific topic, which is intellectual property protection. Since Dan and his colleagues have been working for American companies and let's say Western companies in general, trying to protect their IP in China for over 20 years. So welcome to the show, Dan. How are you doing?
I am great, and I am happy to be here with someone I've known since we first had lunch together. I believe it was in Shanghai.
Oh, wow.
And I'm guessing it was, 2006 even.
A little bit later than that, probably. First time, yes, we sat down and had a meal in Shanghai, close to the bend. Yeah, that takes us back. Right.
I remember the food. It was excellent.
Oh, wow. Yes, fancy Japanese. Yes. All right. So as I mentioned, you have a wealth of experience with IP protection. It's one of the things that you regularly talk about and write about. So I have a few questions for you. And the first one is about the risks, right? Before we talk about what people should do, the first question is, okay, what are the risks? What should we look out for, right? So for Western brands and also Western technology companies, what are the major risks when it comes to intellectual property infringement with relation to China? What would you say are the top top risks that they have to look out for?
Okay, well, I'm going to split your question in two. Mm-hmm. And first answer for manufacturing companies and then technology companies, because the risks are a little bit different. Though what's interesting is that when we started helping Western companies with China, there really were very few technology companies. Our typical client was a company that manufactured shirts or had shirts manufactured in China or computer bags or whatever. And so IP was much less of a big deal. Now we have clients who are having sophisticated products made in China that often involve not just the product itself, but the technology. But I'll start out by answering with respect to manufacturers. And I would say the biggest risk is having their Chinese manufacturer sell the Western company's branded product for less than it costs for the Western company to have it made. And when this happens, it's usually lights out for the Western company,
Oh, yeah.
meaning if you've got somebody who's selling, legally selling your product with your name on it for half, let's say, what you charge, your sales are going to plunge. And the thing that people don't realize is that doing this is basically legal under Chinese law if the Western company has not taken the necessary steps to prevent this. And in a minute, I can talk about what those steps are. But now I'm going to turn to technology companies. And their risks are different in that it's not usually a situation where the Chinese company goes out and starts selling their product with their brand name on it. What the Chinese company might do is take their technology and put it in their own product and then start selling that product, usually as their own. And then the US company or the Western company then all of a sudden has a new competitor. And technology can be tougher to protect, certainly than a brand name, and oftentimes tougher to protect even than a product.
Right. Well, ask Cisco, how about their their former supplier Huawei? These guys learn fast, right?
Well, I probably shouldn't say this, but there are a lot of companies you could ask about Huawei. A
Yes,
lot of Western
right.
companies.
That's for sure. But it was down to the copying of even the user manual with the same typos and things like that. I mean, and then they learned, and then they got more and more sophisticated to the point where they are now a world leader, which is something that nobody would have predicted 20 years ago, right? It's technology. Is very hard to really protect in the long run if you start to operate across borders and teach, low cost producers to make your products, right? I think that that's really true.
Right. Now, what's so interesting about technology companies is that historically and even today, they've underrated the risk of their technology being used by Chinese companies. So, I mean, I could probably tell you a dozen stories where clients of ours licensed their technology to a Chinese company. And they did it. The Chinese company will typically say, yeah, we'll pay you 10 million for the technology. And then when it comes time to say to get the contract signed, the Chinese company will say, well, 10 million, but it's a million a year for the next 10 years. So our response is, okay, then we're just going to dole out the technology after we get paid. And the American company is of the view, and we warn them, look, they're going to stop paying after the fifth or sixth step. And the American company will say, well, if they do that, we don't care because they won't have enough to really do much and compete with us. And we would always tell them, well, yeah, you're laughing because you've seen it. We would say, look, they're going to take that sixth step and they're going to pay their people to get them to step eight. And then our client says, well, but that's still not step 10 where we are. And we're like, yeah, but step eight is enough for them to outsell you in Pakistan, in Guatemala, in countries that are more concerned with price than a technology that's at step 10. And it still happens. And you're
Oh,
right,
yeah.
it's tough to protect when you're essentially helping them learn
Right.
it.
And then give them a few more years and they will be at step 12, maybe. I mean,
You're right.
things also happen at a scale. Just on the Chinese market alone, people don't understand that. But how many nuclear power plants do they build? Like they have an ongoing construction industry and ongoing like engineering work and so on and so forth. And just because of that, they're becoming a world leader, right?
Right.
And other countries have a very tough time competing against that. So
Well,
yeah.
and you talk about scale. With the scale comes speed. And I've been practicing law long enough so that there was a period where being first to market was in itself often a protection. Your product would come out first, and 2 years later, it would get copied, but you already were on your second iteration, so you were always ahead. Nowadays, we're seeing, and I'm not exaggerating, we have companies reach out to us and they say, we sent a design to our manufacturer 6 weeks ago, to our potential manufacturer 6 weeks ago, and now we're seeing our product on the market. What do we do? And I'm like,
Wow.
I don't know.
Wow. Yeah.
I
Yes,
mean,
yes, yes.
you're better positioned to see that speed than I am, but I'm sure you see it. I mean, they can
Yes.
copy something and get it out there way
And
faster than
simplify.
20 years ago.
Yes, and simplify it. What we see very often is, and we warn startups all the time, don't make, big success theater, like a big, pay some big influencers on YouTube to show your product, how nice it is. Big Kickstarter campaign with big numbers. This is going to attract a lot of companies down in Shenzhen to get to market faster than you. Now their product might be, simpler than yours, maybe not as nicely finished and everything. Maybe they do machining instead of, or like, let's say die cast instead of machining and things like that. It's a bit rough and so on. But their production cost is a third of yours, maybe, and then they sell it at less than you buy it, exactly as you were mentioning. And this is a killer, right? We can keep
Well,
going
no,
forever
it's a
about.
very good point because,
Yeah.
and I'm glad you raised that. I have had startup companies say that they cannot afford to protect their IP until after they raise their funds on Kickstarter. And I'll
Yes.
say, after you've raised the funds, there's a good chance that your product is already out on the market and you're a year away from that. I
Right.
mean, there are
Yes.
thousands of Chinese people who read Kickstarter every day.
Yes. Probably more than 1,000. Yes.
You're right. You really only need five, but you're right. It's probably 50,000.
Right. Okay, we keep saying, a lot of things about the risks, but looking back at, let's say, the legal system and the ability to enforce intellectual property in China, have you seen things evolving, let's say, in a positive direction, or still, things not very good? How would you rate the Chinese legal system when it comes to IP protection?
Okay. Again, you're asking me two questions. One is, have I seen things evolve and get better? Yes, I have. I've also seen them get worse after they got better. And now this is my fault, not your fault. I'm going to take the question about the legal system and break that up by saying the legal system has and focus on that, and then I'll focus on the overall system. The legal system from 2000 to, let's say, 2013 got better every year. Since 2013, it's probably gotten a little bit better. China's legal system, in terms of protecting IP, if you do things correctly, is okay. It's not that bad. It gets a bum rap. If you register your trademark in China and someone sells your product with your trademark and it's not cutting edge, your product isn't a cutting edge semiconductor that the Chinese government really cares about. Let's say it's just a rubber ducky. You can sue and win pretty much every time. So the legal system getting better very, very slowly since 2013. But overall, to me, well, not just to me, to people who are, let's say, doing things in China or having their products made in China, I would say that we are in one of the worst periods ever right now. And the reason I say that is because, in terms of real world IP theft, that tends to wax and wane depending on China's economy. When China's economy is doing badly and Chinese companies see a bleak future for themselves, IP theft always accelerates. I've been through, I don't know, four or five cycles in China's economy, and it happens every time. And right now, Chinese companies see a bleak future, and that has been their worldview basically since COVID. And you combine COVID with a declining Chinese economy, which is exactly what is happening out there. Even if you believe the Chinese statistics, which are grossly exaggerated,
Who does?
no, right, nobody believes them, except, well, I was going to say Xi Jinping, but he knows full well not to believe them. So the economy's not doing well. And when you throw onto that the fact that Chinese companies see American companies and to a lesser, slightly lesser extent, European companies trying to leave China for various different reasons, you can start to understand why things are so bad right now. Now, I used to give an IP speech when actually I put where I would insert a PowerPoint, and I actually now put that in almost all the talks I give about China. And the slide says, I don't have it in front of me, so I'm going to be winging it a little here. It says something like, you always want your deal with your Chinese counterparty to be written so that the Chinese company believes it can do better with you than without you. Because once the Chinese company thinks they no longer need you, that's when all hell breaks loose and they start stealing your IP. And another way I put it is that if your Chinese manufacturer or counterparty thinks it can make more from you by manufacturing product for you, it will manufacture product for you. But when it thinks it can make more by stealing from you than by selling to you, it will usually steal from you. Unless there are items, for lack of a better word, in place that make it better for them not to steal from you. And when Chinese companies think they don't view American companies that are asking them to manufacture their widgets, they don't view that as a long-term relationship anymore, nor should they, because they know damn well that American companies are constantly trying to move their manufacturing out of China. Now, it doesn't mean they're going to succeed, but it does mean they're trying. And so they view them as a short-term situation, and that increases their incentive to steal IP. And we're seeing a lot of it these days.
Right. Obviously, we're a bit biased, right? Because people come to you, they tend to have something bad just having happened to them, right? And sometimes they also come to us and they ask us, what should we do and everything. So we might be a little bit biased, thinking that there's a lot of that kind of cheating and so on. There is a lot, of course, but just the sheer size of China, of course, there's some good suppliers and bad suppliers everywhere, right? But I
Correct.
think for a company that buys products in China, I think the key is to think of what's the system that I need to put in place? What's the way I need to frame my agreements with my suppliers and so on and so forth, right? To reduce this likelihood, because over the next, I don't know, 10 years, 20 years, working with X different suppliers, if I don't have a good system in place, something bad will happen to me, right? I think that's sort of a reasonable way to look into that.
I
So
completely agree with you. And what I would say is that there was a period where we did not get many calls from companies having their IP stolen in China. Now we're getting a lot. But if you act appropriately, if you enact the right protections, I actually think, well, first off, even 10 years ago, if you did those things, the odds of you having a problem would go way, way down, like incredibly so. We've probably done 1,000 contracts with Chinese manufacturers, and no exaggeration, we've had probably only two or three clients that have had any problem at all. So if you do things correctly, you're right. The risks are very low. What's interesting is when people come to us, because, and this goes back to what I said at the beginning, they come to us with a problem and they have virtually always done absolutely everything wrong. And there is nothing we can do to help them. And I know you see that same sort of thing as well. And one of the things that companies do wrong, when I give the talk on how to protect your IP, I say there are three keys: good partner, good contract, good protection. And you help them on the good partner side. And that is so important because so many times when it's not the good companies in China that steal IP. It's not the companies with a good reputation that steal IP. There are two or three huge companies in China that our law firm deals with all the time. And they are tough. They're tough negotiators. They're tough to deal with. But they're not going to steal IP. Now, I'm not saying that it's impossible, but, and you probably know two or three. Well, first off, if I gave you the names, you'd know all of them, and you've probably dealt with all of them. But these are big companies that make, let's say, every appliance just about in the United States. That company's not going to steal IP from Samsung, because if it does that, then LG and Whirlpool and Bosch and everybody else who uses them are going to flee. So they're not stupid and they don't make bad economic decisions. And so when people call us and say, my IP, I showed this to this company and now they've gone off and manufactured it, it's usually some crappy company where if we had done a $1,500 due diligence search on them, we would have told them not to even use them. So ignore even the good contract. Just choosing wisely is a terrific protection. Do you agree?
Absolutely. Oh, no, absolutely. You need to make sure that business-wise, it makes sense for the supplier to behave, in an ethical manner. Of course, and that's why, in the context of what we do mostly, which is help companies like develop new products, bring it into production. If they work with here what they call an ODM manufacturer, let's say, oh, we need to develop something. The camera has to be very good. Oh, there's a shortcut. Let's work with this specialized supplier that has these models of cameras that they already developed. Okay, first, is it really something that they themselves developed? Is it their IP? Very hard to know. And then, it's like a shortcut. We don't need to develop and fine-tune our own camera module. We just pick that one and we build the product around them, and they will make the full product. And then I tell them, well, their business revolves around them owning the IP and using the IP to sell to other customers. So do you feel safe teaching them about your concept that you have in mind? Number one, you might not go into production. You're just going to teach them to develop a nice prototype that they will sell to their current customers because the volumes are going to be much better and everything. And then even if it goes into production, they might also sell it to people in Australia or in China or wherever, because it's their business model to start with. Does that make sense?
Yes. And in fact, you raise a very good point, which is that we had a company that came to us. They were making very high-end fitness equipment, and their manufacturer in China was charging them a lot of money to make the fitness equipment. And this company said, we don't want to keep buying from them, but they say that if we use someone else to make the equipment, they will sue us because it will violate their IP. So we looked into it and we came back to them and we said, it will. Your equipment's so good because this Chinese company has two valuable patents. And so if you go off and make this equipment somewhere else, you can't have these two items on your equipment. And they're like, but we want those two items on our equipment. I said, well, but they have the patent. You're going to have to pay them to be able to use it, and they probably won't let you. You should have thought of this before you created this equipment with your name on it and someone else's IP. And they said, well, nobody ever told us. I'm like, well, you didn't ask anybody who knew. And we see that a lot, and more often now, by far, than 10 years ago, because 10 years ago, very few Chinese companies innovated and had valuable patents. Now a lot of them do. And Americans, and to a lesser extent, Europeans, just think that they own absolutely everything when they don't. So when you talk about that camera example, if you're going to use their camera, you're tied to them for life, or you're going to have to find another camera to use.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You said there's three things. Once you've picked the right partner, what is the next topic that comes into play?
Well, there are two, and oftentimes it's contemporaneous. I said the first thing's the right partner. One, I didn't say, well, that is the first thing. The second and third things are the right contracts, the right protections. And by the right contracts, before you show your design to a Chinese company or a Vietnamese company or a Thai company or a Mexican company or a US company or a French company, get them to sign a contract that is actually enforceable in the country in which you want it to be enforced, that says they cannot use what you show them to compete with you, and they cannot reveal it to others. And Americans give a US style NDA to a Chinese company, and then which does not work at all for China. I've had conversations with Chinese lawyers as to whether it's better than having no contract at all, or actually worse. And most people think it's worse than having no contract at all. And I won't go into why that's the case. But if you get them to sign an NNN agreement that in Chinese that allows you to sue them in China, that's what you want 99% of the time, they're far less likely to steal your IP, especially if they're a legitimate company to begin with, because legitimate companies don't want to get sued. If they're a bunch of crooks, the contract has no value because crooks are crooks. And that's another reason why the first step is always to figure out who you're dealing with. So you get that contract signed. What you also do is if your widget is going to be named Renault's Finest, you get a Chinese trademark for Renault's Finest in the category of your widget. And that will prevent anyone in China from putting your brand name on that category of widget. And that's very powerful because at the beginning I said, what's the biggest risk? The biggest risk is someone selling your product with your brand name on it 100% legally. That's lights out usually for a company. We have a lot of companies where somebody is quote unquote selling their product, but without their brand name on it. And oftentimes they can't even quantify. They're not even sure whether it impacts their sales at all. It's just another competitor. So your brand name is key. I mean, if you build up your brand name, for XYZ widgets, you're able to sell that for $29. And there are going to be people who have a similar product without the brand name who are selling it for 15, and that's just the nature of the market.
Right. Yeah, a lot of companies use a brand name as, let's say, the promise to their customers or consumers, right? And they really have to fight to make sure nobody else uses that brand name. Yeah, but it's very counterintuitive for a lot of companies to say, well, of course I need to register a trademark in the countries where I sell the product, but in China I'm just going to make the product, so why would I register the trademark, right? And then you already mentioned earlier, this is a way to go after the companies in China that put your trademark on the product, even for stopping them from making and shipping the product in China. Is that correct?
Correct. That's correct. Right. We had a client that came to us after the problem started, ended up in six different lawsuits in China and the United States. And basically, it was a situation where the Chinese company went off and registered. They had a Chinese manufacturer and they terminated them. Well, that Chinese manufacturer had registered their brand name as their own trademark and started selling it. Now, technically, you can't do that in China, but maybe 10 years ago, China said that if you are an agent for a company, you cannot register their trademark because they were so embarrassed by how often it had ha was happening. Well, Chinese companies aren't stupid. When I said it was their manufacturer, it's not. The manufacturer doesn't go off and the manufacturer in Shenzhen doesn't go off and register the trademark because they all know that it'll get stricken. They have their cousin in Xi'an do it. And then they license it from their cousin in Xi'an, and there's nothing you can do. So it might as well be the same, and that is what happens.
Yeah,
And
and there's
the
no way
thing
even
is,
to find out that is the
there's no
cousin,
way to find
right?
out exactly.
Yeah,
And
yeah.
what you talk about, and you're right, companies think I only need to register my trademark where I sell it. But interestingly enough, over the years, we've probably had 15 or 20 companies that have come to us for a Chinese trademark, even though they don't manufacture their products in China, nor do they sell them in China, nor do they have any plan to sell them in China. And why are they doing that? Because they view it as essentially a cheap way to gain protection worldwide. Now, let me explain. Companies come to us, small companies, oftentimes internet companies that sell cosmetics online or something like that. They'll say, I would like a worldwide trademark. And I'll go, that's great. That's 1.5 million. And they'll go, well, that's way too much. I'd go, okay, let's talk about what really matters. We would probably charge you $25,000 for a trademark in Afghanistan. Is that worth it to you? No. Okay. Well, it's like 1,500 in Mexico. Is that worth it to you? Yes. Okay. So let's figure out where it matters. But the thing is, if you want to cut off the head of the snake, now I'm mixing metaphors here, at its source, you register the trademark in China because counterfeiting comes from China. So if you register it in China for, let's say, 2,000, 2,500 or whatever, then you're in a sense blocking the manufacturing of your product with that trademark in China. So if you're, let's say, a cosmetics company and you sell $20,000 of product to Romania, $20,000 to India, $20,000 to Bulgaria, it's not worth registering your trademark in all three of those places. But you might be able to stop counterfeiting from entering those three places simply by registering in China. Now, it doesn't always make sense, but for certain products, it can make sense. And that's how valuable a Chinese trademark is. And in our firm, we've coined the phrase, a Chinese trademark is the only no-brainer in Chinese law. If you're going to be manufacturing a product in China or selling a product in China, it is the best deal out there. And every day, including today, someone writes me convinced that they need an NNN agreement. And probably 40 to 50% of the time, they don't. And NNN agreements are more expensive than Chinese trademarks. And what they need is a Chinese trademark. It's more valuable because the NNN only protects you against one company, the company that signs it. A trademark protects you against 1.3 billion people in China.
Good
And
point.
it's
Good
cheaper.
point.
So you really have to think about that. Although today I actually had two, and one of them, it was interesting because they thought they needed an NNN agreement. What all they're doing is they're buying two large pieces of heavy equipment. And I said, you don't need an NNN agreement. You don't need a trademark. You need a due diligence report on these companies before you send them $250,000.
Of course. Yeah, it's not about IP protection. Yeah, you need to step back and look at the business risk, right? Of course.
Right. And the risks for every company are going to be different. Most companies need a trademark. We have a company that makes ball bearings without their name on them. Why do they need a trademark? Their name's not on it. That's rare, but it happens.
I could keep going and ask a lot of questions, but instead, what we'll do in the show notes, we'll include some links to some of your articles on your website about the NNN agreement, about the trademark registration in China, and about the manufacturing agreement. I guess that would be maybe good reading for people who want to go a little bit deeper into this. Would you agree?
I would agree, and I'd add one thing to that. An article on the need to do your due diligence on the company you're dealing with.
All right. Okay. Yeah, we'll get some links to some of your past good articles and on the China Law blog, and we'll put it there. If people want to reach out to you, what is the best way? Do they search for Dan Harris in LinkedIn, or maybe Dan Harris Law Firm in Google or something like this?
Dan Harris LinkedIn or Dan Harris Seattle Attorney.
Great. All right. Well, Dan, thank you so much. That was
Thank you.
very, very helpful. And thanks to the listeners, and you will hear from us next week, as usual. So long.
Thanks again for listening to this podcast brought to you by the Sophie's Group. We're on a mission to provide you with everything you need to manufacture effectively in Asia, including inspections, auditing, new product development support, contract manufacturing, 3PL warehousing and fulfillment, and much, much more across Asia's key manufacturing areas. Visit us at sofeast.com, that's SOFEAST.com, to learn more and get help. If you've enjoyed the podcast today, please do rate, review, and share, because it will really help others discover us too.